raising a family to raising almonds. There are many moments in life when having a partner makes everything easier. At Wilbur Ellis, we believe almond bloom is one of those moments. We know a strong bloom is what sets you up for a successful year. That's why when you work with us, you don't just get one partner. You get access to a team of industry-leading experts who bring you real-time answers that can boost your yield and your bottom line. We've also got innovative adjuvants like Embracier that elevate the performance and effectiveness of fungicides, insecticides, and miticides by making sure you get even coverage throughout your orchard. So don't face almond bloom without a partner. Plan for a more successful harvest by teaming up with Wilbur Ellis, because you're never alone when you have the power of we. Contact your local Wilbur Ellis representative today to see what the power of we can do for you.
Focus on the Family on AM 1230 KPRL and 99.3 FM is brought to you by Sculptera Winery and Sculpture Garden. The Frankel family and staff invite you to visit their beautiful world and taste their award-winning estate wine. Open daily 10 to 5 on Lanay Road in Paso Robles.
When we talk about anxiety, there's the spiritual side, and then there's the relationship side. There's the whole person side, so we want to look at it.
The late Dr. Gregory Jantz on Focus on the Family Minute, addressing anxiety.
So the breakout is also a decision. I'm not going to live this way anymore. I'm committed to working through whatever I have to have healing. I'm not going to be bound by this. And there's a decision we make. And maybe at first it's because you're so locked into living with anxiety, it's almost normal. It's not a healthy normal, but you're used to it.
Yeah.
And if you say to a person, no, you don't have to live that way, they're going to go, what? No, I don't get that. So
So
we need to teach a new way to live.
Right.
And I know that it can be done.
You'll hear more hopeful insights from Dr. Jantz on conquering anxiety today when you visit familyminute.org.
Focus on the Family on AM 1230 KPRL and 99.3 FM is brought to you by Sculptera Winery and Sculpture Garden. The Frankel family and staff invite you to visit their beautiful world and taste their award-winning estate wine. Open daily 10 to 5 on Lanay Road in Paso Robles.
Hi, this is Chris from We Help You Legal. Legal documents should be simple and affordable. At We Help You Legal, there are no lawyers and no high costs, just certified experts to assist you with living trusts, wills, divorce matters, corporations, and LLCs.
Hi, I'm Christina. We also offer notary services. You can find us online at wehelpyoulegal.com or call 805-237-7770.
We Help You Legal, your Central Coast legal document company.
Heater not helping much? Call Hutch. Hutch Heating and Air in Atascadero. Just like changing the oil in your car, changing the filter in your heating and air conditioning system will make it last longer and cost less to operate, which means more time in between needing a service technician, like me, Jared. But when you do, please remember us. Heater not helping much? Call Hutch. Hutch Heating and Air in Atascadero. Call us at 466-8199 and on the web at hutchhvac@yahoo.com.
I recently had the best visit with Peter Lussier at Hearing Aid Specialists. He fixed my hearing aid, gave me an efficient hearing test, and adjusted my hearing aids using computer software. I've had my hearing aids for several years. I never felt they were working properly until Peter fixed the issues. The clarity and volume are wonderful now.
If you have hearing aids or need a hearing aid evaluation, call Hearing Aid Specialists of the Central Coast, 805-460-7385, 805-460-7385. Paul Harvey's The Rest of the Story, brought to you by Frontier Floors and Window Coverings at 830 21st Street in Paso Robles. Call 805-238-7878 or online at frontierfloors.net.
The Rest of the Story. Slim Williams was the last of the true Alaskan sourdoughs. Drove sled dogs through the frozen wilderness round the turn of the 20th century. In such a place at such a time, you lived by cunning and died without it. You knew the threshold of your own endurance. You saw where all of the invisible boundaries lay. And then one day, Slim stepped over the line. He got it in his mind that half dog, half wolf would be the ideal sled dog. He got it in his mind to steal some wolf cubs right out of their den and raise them to breed with his own animals. The first part was easy.
There were three of them he snatched when Mama was gone hunting. Three snarling, spitting bundles of black fur. Slim took them back to his camp, chained them among his dogs in the clearing in front of his cabin, and when night fell, Slim built a fire just big enough to light the clearing, and then he sat in the cabin doorway with his rifle leaning against the jamb, and he waited for the rescue party. He would not have to wait long, for as darkness overtook the twilight, Slim noticed that the cubs, who'd been curled up sleeping, became alert, began staring in the same direction into the shadows beyond the jumping firelight. They'd sniffed something, heard something, perhaps even seen something, but whatever had drawn their attention, why were neither Slim nor his dogs aware of it? Now, if anyone, Slim Williams knew the natural sounds of the woods in the north in the night. And yet what he slowly began to hear, so faint at first that he suspected his imagination, he had never heard before. And then gradually, fearfully, Slim identified the sounds, the voices of wolves. Largest vocabulary of just about any animal on earth. That's what wolves have. Of course, they have barks and cries and howls and whines, but the soft, subtle language Slim heard that night included eerie, guttural tones and seeming whispers and an astonishing dictionary more. The wolf voices were everywhere, surrounding the clearing, even behind the cabin. The voices of would-be rescuers, Slim realized, but for once in his rugged, road-worn life, Slim was wrong. For in addition to talkative, wolves are smart. Smarter than any animal in the bush. Smart enough to know the odds against rescuing three cubs from a pack of dogs and a man with a gun. So what those quiet, cryptic words in the darkness were doing was teaching. Teaching. Telling the abducted little ones all of the things that there'd not been time to tell when they were snuggled safe at their mother's side. But there's one thing more that wolves can do. They can throw their voices like ventriloquists. And that's why for half an hour or so, Slim and his dogs kept looking all around them, while the wolf cub's gaze was calmly trained on a single point in the distance. For there was no pack of wolves in the shadows surrounding the clearing. There was only one. A lone mother wolf who had come to say goodbye and was then gone forever. Now you know the rest of the story.
This hour of Sound Off on KPRL brought to you by Buy the Book Heating and Air, your local reliable heating and air expert. Call 805-423-5119.
238-5775. 238-KPRL. Sound Off continues on KPRL, the North County's number one choice for news, talk, and sports. This is Sound Off on the right choice, KPRL.
Welcome back to Sound Off. My name is Karen Veely, your host on Wednesday and Thursday afternoon. Tomorrow I'll have Atascadero Councilman Seth Peek discussing the issues that are going on in Atascadero. But today I have Clint Cole. He is the cold case investigator for the San Luis Obispo County Sheriff's Department. And after he solved the Kristen Smart case, he actually retired and then decided to come back to get some other cases done. You're working part-time now, correct?
That's correct. Usually 2 days a week. I can only work up to like 960 hours. Because I'm retired, so they monitor my hours, and so it turns out about 2 days a week works out where I can work most of the year.
And so I really want to get in first. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened in 1980 in San Miguel?
Yeah, so it was May 17th, it was a Saturday, 1980. San Miguel had about 800 residents at the time. There was a family called the Mezos, M-E-Z-O, and the Flores family. Teresa Flores was 5 years old. One of her good friends, Martha Mezo, was 4 years old. And the two families allowed the kids, you know, they were friends. Some people have always thought they were related. They weren't. They were friends. And the girls were close, and they had Teresa had an older sister who, a couple years older, about 8 years old, and they would stay the night at each other's houses and you know, just do normal stuff back then. On this Saturday in 1980, one of Teresa's aunts was having a birthday party, and so the girls were excited. They were all hanging out at Teresa's house. They had gone in. So Teresa's house is, if you know San Miguel, it's across the railroad tracks off in between 11th and 12th Street, in that little trailer park area there. Back then, it was a little more thriving than it is now, but that's where Teresa lived. And their aunt, Teresa's aunt Virginia, was going to take the girls to town because they wanted some candy. They were upset. They didn't get to go to the riverbed with the older girls, so they were crying. So parents did what most parents do and give them candy. So they sent the girls to town. When I say sent to town, it's just literally across a couple streets, if you know San Miguel. They first stopped at the post office with the Aunt Virginia. The girls asked to walk up to Witkowski's Market, which the building is still there. It's a different market now. And it's just past the Elkhorn, which is obviously still there. And so the girls walked up, had gone in the store. People knew them inside the store, told law enforcement, yes, they were here. They bought some candy. And they were walking away. About that time, Virginia comes back up and talks to the girls, and they were going to be going down to Martha's house, which was in the 1,000 or 1,000 block of Mission Street.
So on the same street as Elkhorn.
Yes, all of these streets, the post office, Elkhorn, and Witkowski's are all on Mission. And so, and they're very, you can see them very easily. So if you're at Witkowski's, you can see in front of Martha's house. I know some people have, you know, oh my gosh, why were these girls walking alone? In 1980, it was different. The aunt could see them. These weren't these long city blocks with, you know, a bunch of, you know, distractions on the roadway. It was 1980.
And children walked to school in kindergarten unaccompanied in 1980.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I was the school resource officer for Lillian Larson 14 years ago, and kids would still walk to school. So it's not, you know, it wasn't that uncommon. The girls had gone into the Elkhorn to get a soda, and they did have someone buy them a soda. They walked out of the Elkhorn and started southbound on Mission towards Martha's house. They were supposed to meet Martha's mom, who her name was Sunday. It's short for a longer name. But Sunday was going to take them into Foster Freeze, the old Foster Freeze down the road here, and get them hamburgers and ice cream at noon. So this is about 11:15, 11:30 in the morning. That's what everyone expected the girls to do. There was a family friend who says she saw the girls, and she knew the girls well. Her kids were playing with Teresa's older sister that same morning. And so she knew them, and she swears, she's deceased, so I haven't ever been able to talk to her myself, but they did in 1980. And she says that she swears the girls were walking across 11th, up 11th Street across the railroad tracks as if they were going to Teresa's house. It's unknown for sure if that was accurate and the time frame is accurate, because the girls did go to town a couple times that day. But that was the last time the girls were seen, was coming out of the Elkhorn and either headed towards Martha's house or the neighbor friend seeing them just across the street from Mission Street. And that's around 11:30. At noon, Sunday, Martha's mom goes to her house as planned. The girls are not there. So she immediately drives to Teresa's house, asks, you know, where's the girls? They're not there. Teresa's mom says, hey, I thought you had them. She says, no, I thought you had them. So kind of the mad panic sets in, and the families all, they're both fairly large families. So they both start looking. They go up to San Miguel Park. They go in the riverbed. They start searching all the areas downtown again. And until 4 o'clock, they had finally decided it was time to call the sheriff's office when they had not seen any sign of the girls.
And at that time, San Miguel was not a busy place. It was a small community.
Yeah, that's correct. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't even as busy as it is now. Not even close. You know, on a Saturday morning, you had a few people going to the market, a few people at the bar, you know, people milling around a little, but it certainly wasn't, you know, super busy down there at that time.
And so they don't find them. How long would it be before they found the bodies, and where did they find them?
So the sheriff's office did a massive search with the National Guard, fellow law enforcement, horseback, ATVs, helicopters, foot. And they did not find the girls until 12 days later on May 29th under an overpass on East Garrison Road, kind of near the Camp Roberts entrance is East Garrison, and that takes you kind of the back way, away off of Highway 101, takes you towards Bradley. And there's an overpass there. There's the railroad overpass well that has a very distinct kind of railroad crossing. The girls were found underneath that overpass in the sand, kind of surface buried. One of the little girl's hands was partially sticking out of the sand.
And what was the cause of death, and were they assaulted?
The cause of death was asphyxiation by strangulation. One of the girls had some trauma to her head, and one of the girls had been sexually assaulted.
And so what happened at that time? Did they have suspects? What happened at that time with the sheriff's department?
You know, they did have suspects in 1980. They were a little concerned about Teresa's father because there was a custody dispute, but he was ruled out immediately. He had a very strong alibi. There were some sexual registrants living in town at the time, and so they looked at a lot of those. For the most part, it was a whodunit. Couple days into the investigation, a parole officer from Salinas called investigators to give them the name of Richard Benson. Some people in San Luis Obispo County will recognize that name. Richard Benson, later on in 1986, killed 4 people in Napomo and was convicted of that crime and given the death penalty. He recently died on death row. Prior to dying, I was able to go interview Richard Benson and get his DNA. But going back to 1980, the weekend of May 17th, 1980, he, without his parole officer's permission, went from Salinas. And Richard Benson, I should say, was a serial child rapist as well. He went from Salinas down here to Pismo Beach with some friends. No one could ever put him in San Miguel, but everybody knows, the freeway runs right by it, so it's possible. So they looked at Richard Benson very hard. They interviewed him multiple times, could never develop any evidence or anything. He was lying about his alibi. He had the people he was with lie about his alibi. But they could never develop anything further to charge Benson. And then in 1986, he commits this other heinous crime. And the district attorney's office at the time asked that prosecutors stop interviewing Benson on the little girl's case because they didn't want it to interfere with the current death penalty case. And so Benson, some of the old timers to this day still believe Benson is the killer.
Were you able to rule it out, though, because of DNA?
I was able to rule Benson out from one piece of DNA evidence, yes. We do have DNA evidence that has been in CODIS, the data bank, the National Data Bank of DNA. That's been in there since 2009. So we knew Benson wasn't him on that piece of evidence because he was in CODIS, but I still went and got his DNA anyway, in case we developed further evidence, and then we could just do a direct comparison just to make sure, because sometimes mistakes are made, you know, when you're uploading. Benson was in prison when the mandatory DNA testing took over. They tested everybody in state prison. So a mistake could have been made. So I made sure that we got Benson's direct DNA. There was another guy who ended up on death row as well. Francis was his first name. And he killed very similarly.
We're going to get back and hear about another suspect after a word from our sponsors.
This Fox Business News update on KPRL is brought to you by Stifel, your full-service wealth management firm since 1890. Stifel, located at 1337 Vine Street in Paso Robles. Call 805-238-3080. Stifel, 238-3080.
I'm Liz Klayman, and this is the Fox Business Report.
Stocks ending higher on rate cut optimism after new data from ADP showed that the private sector shed 32,000 jobs in November, which was more than economists were expecting. The report is leading investors to be hopeful that the Fed will be slashing interest rates when they meet next week. Financials and industrials gained while tech lagged, and shares of the Magnificent Seven tech stocks were mixed. Microsoft stock fell nearly 2% on a report that said that the tech giant was easing sales quotas for enterprise AI products. Microsoft has denied the report. And the price of Bitcoin continues to climb after suffering a decline earlier in the week and is trading around $93,000. The Dow winners, Goldman Sachs, United Health, and American Express. The Dow decliners, Microsoft, Travelers, and Boeing. The Dow up 408 points, the Nasdaq higher by 40, S&P 500 up 20. That's your Fox Business Report. I'm Hillary Barsky, invested in you.
If a Lenovo computer for your business is on your holiday list, don't shop around. Just go directly to the source, Lenovo.com. It's your last chance to get exclusive deals on the PCs you want for your business, like the ThinkPad X9 14 Aura Edition and Yoga 7i 2-in-1. So avoid all that shopping chaos and price comparing, and just go directly to the source, Lenovo.com, where PCs are up to 35% off. That's Lenovo.com.
Lenovo, Lenovo.
This Fox Business News update on KPRL brought to you by Stifel, your full-service wealth management firm since 1890. Stifel, located at 1337 Vine Street in Paso Robles. Call 805-238-3080. Stifel, 238-3080.
When it comes to your vision, experience matters. At Michael's Optical in Atascadero, Michael and Kathy Nutt have been helping our community see clearly since 1979, and that's over 45 years of family-owned care and service. From infants to adults, you'll find frames and lenses for every style and budget, including trusted names like Silhouette, Oakley, Ray-Ban, and Maui Jim. Need glasses in a hurry? With the Michael's in-house finishing lab, you get fast, high-quality eyewear plus custom adjustments and repairs done on site. There's convenient parking, convenient Saturday hours 10 to 4. And ask about their VIP savings and exclusive pricing on eyewear and lenses. Michael's Optical, 8300 El Camino Real, Atascadero, hometown service and focused on you.
Michael's Optical.
The Sound Off lines are open at 238-5775. 238-KPRL. The North County's listening to you on Sound Off.
Welcome back to Sound Off. My name is Karen Vealey, your host. Today I have Clint Cole. He's a cold case investigator. We are going over a 1980 murder of two young women in San Miguel. And there is a possibility they will have this case solved in the near future. But right now we're going over how they went about this. And again, 1980, this is a cold, cold case.
Yes, it is. It is. We do have evidence that we're working on. So, and when we use the term cold case, what that refers to is at the time right now, usually the case isn't actively being worked or there's no active, like really hot leads. It's kind of, in this case, it's not really a cold case because it's being actively worked, but they kind of just, cold case is just kind of what we call these cases because they're so old. So as I was saying before the break, there was several other suspects, another serial killer. We've cleared him through some of our evidence. They had a young kid, 16 years old, by the name of Greg Hickey, who knew the girls, had a fight with Martha's half-brother the night before. He was actually arrested for other charges, and they looked at him very hard as a 16-year-old kid. His story was kind of all over the place. He was a troubled youth. My partner, Detective Rabashadi, and I have also gone and swabbed him and cleared him from some of our evidence. And he's recently deceased. And so we try to get, as soon as we feel somebody needs swabbed, we try to get on them on these old cases so they don't die on us before we get their DNA.
And what were some of the other suspects that you have looked at during this case?
There is a family friend, a guy by the first name of Roy, who knew the girls, lived really close to Teresa, had a van. It was always rumored, kind of a folk tell, never confirmed in San Miguel, that the kids were seen getting into a van. That was never confirmed. But it's, if you go talk to old-time residents now, they'll tell you that story, that just keeps circulating. But Roy owned a van. He had driven the girls before, knew them. We've cleared him as best we can. There were several other sexual assault registrants who we've cleared. And then the case, at one point, one of the lead investigators at the time in the looked at Henry Lee Lucas, the famed false confessor. They looked at him for this and tried to get him to confess to this, but Henry was in Jacksonville, Florida when this crime happened. So, and then
they spent years on that, didn't they?
They spent a couple of years on Henry Lee Lucas, yes. And they actually asked the DA to file charges, which luckily the DA said no at the time. But Henry Lee did not do this crime. He was in Jacksonville, Florida. We have proof of that. He was at a scrapyard in Jacksonville, Florida, 2 days before and after this happened. And this is 1980. Henry Lee Lucas was a drifter. It's not like he's going to jump on a Learjet, drive to San Miguel, and drive back to, or fly back to Jacksonville. So he had a very strong alibi. There's no way he did this. And then the case goes cold. And when I talk about this case, I'm not discrediting anybody who's worked on it before at all. I'm just, you know, stating the facts. And the case kind of goes cold because, in their defense, most of our unsolved, we have 41 unsolved homicides still that we're working on some. And they're all from the 70s, 80s, and 90s. For whatever reason, our neighboring counties have the same issue, like Santa Barbara, I'm buddies with them, Monterey, Ventura. For some reason, the 70s, 80s, and 90s were just bad. And so shortly after they were working on this case, within another couple weeks, a month, they got another homicide. And, you know, they didn't have the amount of investigators that we do now. They certainly didn't have the technology that we do now. If this case had happened this weekend, we would have probably already had a suspect identified with cell phones, Google location data, cell phone data. There's so many things, cameras, you know, everybody has a camera now. So, you know, I'm not discrediting anything prior investigators did. It, you know, we have a lot more technology. So, but at some point, the case does go what we call cold and doesn't get worked on for a long time. In 2006, a detective who was not assigned the case as his own case, he just kind of worked on it on his own time, in his spare time. He's the one that took the DNA evidence that we do have and got it uploaded into the CODIS data bank, and it's been uploaded since 2009. We have recently located some new evidence. There was a hair found on a blue towel. This was all in the podcast that we're having analyzed now.
And so the blue towel was found where?
The blue towel was found near the girls' burial site with their clothing. And so we believe that it is part of this crime. Well, we know this is part of our crime scene. We believe the hair is, since the girls were Hispanic, this hair is not dark. We believe this hair could lead us to our killer. And we are currently working on it. We have the Sacramento County District Attorney's Office genealogy folks working with us. They've been working on this case with us for a long time. They work tirelessly. We owe them tremendously. They don't have any skin in the game. They just want to help us solve this case.
And so what if they're looking to tie this to genealogy, and then you can go speak to people who match the genealogy?
Yeah, so what we're hoping is we can actually identify the actual owner of that hair, whether they're alive or not. Let's say they're alive, then what we would do is we would go, okay, this hair supposedly belongs to this person. Then we locate that person and we get a surreptitious DNA from him, or well, we know it's a him. We get a surreptitious DNA from him. And then we confirm that it's him. And then we then write a warrant, go back, get a swab, and it would do an interview. And potentially that could be our suspect or lead us to our suspect. If per se, this person is deceased, then we, through the genealogy, we locate very close family members. We get try and get them to cooperate with us, and then we can prove that based on their genealogy, we can prove that that hair is, in fact, let's say it's, we find a sister of the hair owner, we can swab her, and the genealogist can say, without a doubt, that is her brother's hair.
And so at that point, if the person is alive, you'll go get a search warrant and interview them.
Absolutely, yeah. No, we would first learn as much as we can about them, you know, do a big history dive on them, their criminal history, where they've been, confirm, try and prove they were in San Miguel in 1980, this weekend of 1980. And then we certainly want their DNA where we witness it, you know, so we 100%, like I did with Richard Benson, 100%, we know that's Benson's DNA that we've used to clear him. We would do the same thing with this person, and then certainly would do an intense interview with this person to find out how their hair got on this towel.
And sometimes, and I watched another case. I got this off a podcast. But it was a missing person case, and they were able to find the person not by their specific, but by a relative's.
Correct.
And they went and talked to the relative and were able to find male relatives and find the person.
Yeah, so you can also, if you have, so we have done that. With the other piece of DNA evidence that we talked about that is in CODIS, we have done what you're talking about. It's called a familial search. So we not only are looking for the exact donor of that DNA, we have done twice now. Back in 2017, I did it, and then I did it again about a year ago, where we did familial searches, where we're looking in the CODIS data bank. We're looking for a close family member, brother, sister, son, daughter, mother, father. It's about as close as you can get. And so we can do a search with that. This hair is not in CODIS because it's a different kind of DNA. It's not what we call STRs, which get uploaded into CODIS. This is mitochondrial DNA, which is kind of like a nuclear type DNA that we can only do direct comparisons to. And so that's why we can't do a familial search on the hair. The hair had damage to it, so we weren't able to extract the STR DNA. That's why we had to go to the mitochondrial DNA, which is still just as good for the most part, except we can't upload it to CODIS.
And because you can't upload it, how do they compare it?
With direct comparison and through genealogy. The beautiful thing about genealogy is that that hair is turned into what is called a SNP, S-N-P. That is what is uploaded into the genealogy sites. So if I, I'll use myself as an example. If I want to find long-lost relatives, I swab myself. I turn that swab into Ancestry or whichever site I choose. They turn that DNA into a SNP. That's what they send back to me that I then start looking for the donor or for family members that match my DNA. So in the case of the hair, we're doing the exact opposite. We have an unknown, and we're trying to, instead of having my known DNA and finding relatives, we have an unknown person. We're either trying to find that, we're trying to find that person through relatives that have uploaded themselves into the system.
And do you have any idea when you'll get the reports back?
Well, unfortunately with genealogy, it's not like a regular report. The genealogy comes back just when they identify the person. Whereas if on the STR stuff, yeah, we send a piece of evidence to the lab, they extract the DNA from it, they put it in CODIS, and we get a match. You get that in a couple weeks to a couple months if there's a rush on it. this kind of genealogy search, it's just when they find the person is when we get notified.
But they're actively doing it now.
Oh, yes, absolutely. All weekend, these people are extremely dedicated. All through the holiday weekend, I was taking phone calls from them, answering questions for them, giving them information from people in the case file so that they can look at family trees to try and identify the donor of that hair. They were literally doing this case during their Thanksgiving holiday break.
We're going to take a break, a word from our sponsors, and we will be back with more with Cold Cases.
For decades, K-John's Jewelry Company has believed in something simple. Honesty matters. And that's why we never discount. No inflated prices, no gimmicks, just fair, everyday value on jewelry we're proud to stand behind. But today, something truly special is happening. K-John's is embarking on a new chapter, one built on our own creativity and our own craftsmanship. After years of partnering with incredible designers, we're excited to introduce our very own K-John's designs in the coming year. To make room for this collection, we're liquidating our entire current inventory, and we're offering it at genuine, significant discounts. As a heartfelt thank you to the customers and community who have supported us for generations. This isn't a sale for the sake of sales. It's a once-in-a-lifetime transition, a chance for you to own something beautiful at prices we will never offer again. December 2nd through Christmas Eve, we invite you to come in, explore, and be a part of this incredible next step in the K-John's story. K-John's Jewelry Company, where integrity shines as brightly as the jewelry itself.
At Peak Painting, we get it. Hiring contractors can be frustrating. Missed calls, no callbacks, endless waiting for even a price. We do things different. You can book your quote right on the spot. And to top that off, you will have a detailed quote and price before we leave. Painting is easier with Peak.
Hi, I'm Seth Peak.
And I'm Ryan Peak.
And we're the Peak Brothers. From cabinet painting to interior painting.
Exterior painting, both residential and commercial.
We're your go-to family-owned and operated painting company serving all of Slo County. We look forward to working with you. To learn more and book your appointment, visit Peak Painting at peekpainting.com.
I am Central Coast Attorney Dave Duringer, and I believe in faith, family, and freedom. Without faith and family, there is no freedom. So the mission of my law firm, Protective Law Corporation in Morro Bay, is to help families grow family power by transmitting life, fortune, and honor to descendants. The plans I draft include lifelong subtrusts for kids, which protect them from creditors, predators, divorce, and maybe themselves, depending on control. You can even incentivize postmortem transmission of values you care about. But that works better if you get buy-in now. Holiday meals are the perfect time to adopt, implement, and refine your family mission statement. If you are serious about asset protection and family protection, call me, Dave Duringer of Protective Law Corp in Morro Bay. Dial 805-225-5105. Or just click on my phone number at lawnews.tv. Again, lawnews.tv. LAWNEWS.TV.
Welcome back to Sound Off. My name is Karen Vili, your host on Wednesday and Thursday afternoons. And today I have San Luis Obispo County Sheriff's Detective Clint Cole. He runs the cold case filings, and as he said, they're actually not cold when they're investigating them, but that's what we've called them for years. We talked about the case of the two young girls in San Miguel. We'll get an update. Will you give us an update when you find out so we can tell when you find out on the hair, we'll update our listeners. But you also had another recent cold case that you solved. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. And before I do talk about that case, I would like to encourage, the reason I'm here is to encourage anybody that may know information through other family, however you might know it, please don't assume that the sheriff's office knows the information. Please don't assume it's probably nothing. Since the local, since the podcast was done, we've gotten quite a few nice tips and phone calls on the case, where we've gotten some new persons to look at. I would urge you, I know there are still residents in San Miguel, because I've spoke to them, that were there in 1980. If you know anything, please call us. Don't assume we know it. Don't assume it's not important. Sometimes it just takes one little thing. The military was in town, you know. If you know anything at all, please come forward and let us let us know the information. So yes, my partner, Jeff Rabashadi, who works with me part-time as well, he has his primary job is the lovely task of keeping track of all of our sex offenders. So he has time to help me, and he's been a huge help to me. And while I've been busy on the Kristen Smart case since I've come back, you know, in our search to bring Kristen home to her family, Jeff has been very busy working on a case. That victim's name is Dorothy Tate. Dorothy was visiting here from Colorado in 1983, and she was in kind of like a live-in van. It was kind of like a, not a full-on RV, but it was a van that you could live in, you know, kind of like the old Volkswagen Bug vans you could live in. She had a van. She was parked up near north of San Simeon on a little pullout, and somebody shot her in the head in 1983, took some stuff from her van, a very back then high-tech brand new Nikon camera. That case was another complete whodunit. Investigators worked it very hard. They were eventually able to track down the camera to a pawn shop in Bakersfield, but never could lead to any suspects. So that case went cold for a really long time. Nobody really worked on it. I started looking at it before I retired, and we had some evidence. We had some blood that looked like a suspect cut themselves. So when they shot Dorothy, she was still in the driver's side of her van. It looked like she was trying to maybe get away based on crime scene photos, and they shot her in the head with a .45 caliber handgun. And so she rolls just a small ways, hits their car, rolls a small ways, stops, and they go in and move her from the front seat because she would have been visible to Highway 1. She was that close. And at one point, somehow, one of the suspects cut himself. And there was a trail of blood droplets that led from her van to where the suspect's vehicle was parked. And so they collected swabs of those blood droplets in 1983. And so we did what I talked about. We sent that to a lab who turned those into what we call SNPs. Sent that to a genealogy site. On this case, we used Parabon, who some people may be familiar with. And Parabon was able to identify a person who they believed was the owner of the blood droplets.
And are they still alive?
They are not. And so there's a second suspect who's also deceased, who we identify differently. I'll talk to you real quick. Also, so what I was just talking about was what we did. So we, through the genealogy family trees, we learned this person, his name is Stephen. The DA's office is reviewing this case. And so as soon as the DA's office reviews the case and lets us know it's okay, then we will be able to talk more freely about it and actually do a press release most likely. But Stephen's blood, he had a sister who was living in Phoenix. So I reach out to a buddy who works for Phoenix PD, who went out, found the sister. She was totally cooperative, supported law enforcement. We're very honest with them. We tell them what we're doing. We don't, you know, lie or tell stories. We tell them we're investigating a murder, and it's possible your brother was involved. So she said, oh my gosh, you know, I hope not. She gave us her DNA, and through the genealogy, we were able to confirm that Stephen was, in fact, who is a resident in Texas, was, in fact, in San Simeon and left his blood at our crime scene. So he had a partner in crime who was there that day, and how we put him there was back in 1983, he left a Coke can next to the crime scene. And for whatever reason, they were never able to make the fingerprints of Charlie, who's our second suspect. And our fingerprint analyst, Shelby Liddell, who works for the sheriff's office, she's our crime scene analyst, does an amazing job. Was able to, all these years later, however many years it is, looked at that Coke can, was able to identify the fingerprints belonging to Charlie, and then there's a confirmation process, so both Charlie and Stephen are the ones that killed Dorothy Tate, most likely. There was no evidence of sexual assault or anything of that nature. Most likely it was a theft. And so as soon as the DA completes their review of the case, then we will be announcing that. One of the reasons these jobs, these cases, I work on them, is Dorothy has a sister who's still alive. And so she knows that we know. She doesn't know who it is yet, but she knows that we know who killed her sister, and she wants to come out here, and you know, that's the rewarding part of this case, of these jobs, these cases, is to give family answers. You know, for all these years, she's never known what happened to her sister. Just another complete whodunit, minding her own business, a true victim, and two guys try and rob her, take money, and shoot her in the head.
You know, I think it's important, though, to solve these, and because the person could be alive, and to get these put to bed.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, we want to close them, and if the suspect is alive, that makes it even better, because, you know, they do need to suffer the consequences. And I would like to take this time to just let everybody out there know how supportive Sheriff Parkinson is on these cases. These cases take money. All this genealogy, all of this turning DNA into SNPs, this all takes money. And Sheriff Parkinson is very, very supportive. He's the one who got this cold case position. He's the one that continues to support it. And he has never, in the Kristen Smart case, any case, he has never said no to any cost when it comes to trying to solve one of these unsolved homicides. He's very supportive, and I just think it's important that citizens out there know that these types of cases are high priority for Sheriff Parkinson, and he's never said no to anything.
And he made a big deal about the Kristen Smart, but it was a group effort for solving this. And it's impressive. After all these years, you were asked to solve it, and you solved it.
Well, and I had a lot of help, too. I want that to be known. You know, on a large case like the Smart case, everybody knows who followed the case. We did a wiretap. I can't do all that by myself, so I had lots of help.
And I want to thank you very much for coming on the show, and I hope you come back again as you keep solving these cases.
I would love to. I would love to solve more and have a reason to come back.
Sounds great.
Thanks, Karen.
And thank you for listening.
This hour of Sound Off was brought to you by Mid-State Precious Metals across the parking lot from the movie theater in Atascadero. Honest, veteran-owned. Buy or sell precious metals with integrity. Monday through Friday, 10 to 3.
AM 1230 KPRL, 99.3 FM, KPRL.com. Paso Robles, Atascadero, Templeton.